that included records of burglaries during the time when he was a teenager, and even information about a complaint against him as an 8-year-old in 1960, where it was said that he had burned a neighborhood girl's underwear.
So when they take the silver dollar, they got to go around different banks and cash it in.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City, with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we're gonna stray off of task just a little bit. You know, we usually do some kind of mafia stuff or organized crime story, or tell you about some old mob guy, how he used to kill people all over the place. Well, we're going to talk about a modern day killer. And a lot of those mob guys, you could call them serial killers, because they killed, like, Sammy Gravano. How many people did he kill? Aaron, do you remember? Like 30 some, oh, or 20 or something like that. I don't know.
Frank Calabrese Sr., who was indicted for, it was 18 murders.
18 murders, yeah.
You're talking about, you know, Frank the German Suisse. These guys, you know, this was not just a hobby. I think they enjoyed it.
I think they did too. So tonight we're going to talk about a serial killer, and we have in the studio my good friend, Ian Cummings. Ian Cummings is a Kansas City Star reporter, and he did a 6-part series on a local guy who was a really interesting story. He got away with this for, I don't know, 20 years or so. I worked on this case, so I'll talk a little bit about my experiences working on this guy and how we couldn't get him back in the day. And Ian's going to talk about the investigation and all his investigation and what he uncovered. He knows a lot more about it than any single policeman does now, I promise you that, except maybe the case agent that actually helped him, case officer that helped him put together and get the most recent case filed on this guy. His name is Bob Gross, or Robert Gross. But first, let me introduce you to Ian Cummings. Welcome. Now, I'm glad to have you here tonight, Ian.
Hey, thanks for having me, Gary.
Great. So, Ian, first of all, tell us and the wiretappers out there a little bit about yourself. Where'd you go to school, and how'd you get in the news business?
Okay. I'm from Kansas City myself. I grew up around here, and I've been at the Star for about 3 years, a little bit more than 3 years. In between times, I went to University of Kansas. I worked for a little while at the newspaper in Lawrence, the Lawrence Journal World. I went down to Florida and worked at a newspaper in Sarasota, and came back up here to the Star. And I've been on the crime desk at the Star for 3 years. I'm still there.
Well, cool. So you're a Jayhawk, huh?
That's right.
I'm not sure. Do you have your pass?
Always.
You're in Tiger Country now, yeah. You know.
Do you use your press pass just to go, you know, sit next to Bill Self at the basketball games?
I wouldn't get within 100 yards. No way.
You can't use a press pass to slip into the Jayhawks games over there?
No, I have no pass. Now I did when I was on the night desk at the Star. I got a pass for Kauffman Stadium during the playoffs in the World Series, in case there should be an emergency that I would have to cover as a breaking news reporter.
Yeah, right.
And I did sneak out of the office for one of those games against Toronto, but I had to confess to my editor when I got back that I had snuck away.
And you didn't really have a story. Well, you did, but it didn't involve anything that was going to be printed.
Nothing you could put in the paper. And he told me, go forth and send no more.
I mean, that would be a great, you know, breaking news, and there you are down at Sprint Center, you know, watching Justin Bieber from the sidelines.
I could be there. I could be there. No problem.
It's a lot closer than Lawrence if you're working for the Star.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you know, we had a breaking news story at a World Series once. We had a local politician named Harry Wiggins, and he had given his tickets away to another politician I can't remember his name all of a sudden, but somebody went to Harry Wiggins, who was out there at another, he had some kind of cushy box seat at the Royals in the World Series game, and it must have been the 1980 World Series. And he went to, somebody came to Mr. Wiggins and said, you know that Nick Civella's sitting in your box seats? He said, what? So he goes over there. And in the meantime, a star reporter got wind of it somehow, whoever was working out there. And he went down there, too, and tried to interview Nick Civella and then watched Harry Wiggins try to kick him out of his seat.
That wasn't Harry Jones, was it?
No, it wasn't a reporter that went down. It was a sports reporter, whoever happened to be on the desk. No, it wasn't Harry Jones. Anyhow, so let's start talking about Robert Grossin. And folks, this guy has been around a long time. He's a local guy. Grew up in, where did he grow up?
South Kansas City.
South Kansas City. Where did he go? Did he go to grade school and then he go to high school out there at Ruskin or Center?
He went to Bishop Hogan.
Oh, he went to private school. That's right.
He went to Bishop. Ultimately graduated from a different school. I think it might have been O'Hara or Ruskin. But he, for years, attended Bishop Hogan. Yeah.
Like his principal when he was a kindergartner, first grade, second grade, all the way through sixth or seventh. I don't know. But do you think that they said, Bishop Hogan?
I don't know.
Maybe.
Interesting thing about that picture, they put a picture of Gross on the football team at Hogan, and one of his fellow players was our mayor, Sly James.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was. And one of his lawyers, I found out since then, a guy who represented him in one of his many cases, was also on that team, a guy named John Turner. So it was a real local, homegrown deal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of celebrities in different ways.
Yeah.
Not everyone wanting to be the kind of celebrity that this guy is,
really,
though.
So Ian went way back into his history. How did you find all those details about when he was a kid?
Well, once we started looking into Robert Gross's history, we pulled some documents from the federal courthouse where he had been prosecuted in the 1980s. And in all of that paperwork, there were documents from the investigations that police had done in the 1980s, and they had gathered information about Gross's early life that included records of burglaries during the time when he was a teenager and even information about a complaint against him as an 8-year-old in 1960, where it was said that he had burned a neighborhood girl's underwear when he was 8 years old.
Wow. So he started this at 8 years old, then this kind of weird obsession with women and wanting to hurt them. In my mind, the fact he would burn a neighbor girl's underwear at 8 years old indicated this guy had a problem with sex, with the opposite sex in some manner at that age, wouldn't you say?
Many people who analyzed his history, not just us, but many others, pointed to that as an early warning sign that there was something wrong. Even when the police sent the Gross file to the FBI Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico in the 80s, with this laundry list of complaints and suspicions that they had about him, that early incident from when he was 8 years old stood out to an FBI profiler.
No, I can imagine. So what were some of the other early incidents that you've stumbled across?
In those court files and then from accounts of the people who were involved, it starts in 1960 when he's 8 years old and this incident with the neighbor girl. Then when he's about 13 years old, he's reportedly caught in a neighbor's house uninvited, getting into the underthings of a young girl who lives in the house. A couple years later, once again, he's caught in a neighbor's house, in the home of this woman, once again having gotten into her underthings. Both times caught by police. He was a teenager, so it wasn't, you know, they didn't make a felony adult case on him. But those were some of his early, and he stayed out of trouble, as far as we know, for some years until his 20s.
Yeah, he just didn't get caught. It's been my opinion, and usually those are just the tip of the iceberg. You get caught on a couple of things like that. That means you got away with about 10 or 15 more that are probably exactly like that. He learned that stalking and getting in people's houses and creeping around at a really early age.
Well, and it must not at this point, you know, when he's 8 years old and it's 1960, they didn't have like the three-time offender rule.
No.
Right, and much less understanding of what those kinds of offenses at that age signal for someone's future.
Right. You wouldn't even thought about it.
I don't know about you, but I, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, I had an interest in girls, and if I got caught for anything, it would have been looking through my dad's Playboys.
Yeah, well, that's more of a normal kind of.
I don't know if that makes me a weirdo too, but.
Well, we found the woman whose house he had gotten into at age 15, and we spoke with her for a long time. And I should say I worked on this story with two other reporters, Tony Rizzo and Glenn Rice, who are longtime reporters mm-hmm. at The Star. And this woman who at the time of this burglary in 1965, 1967, she was a young woman, early 20s, same age as Gross, she was in her early 20s, she would have been in his teens.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke with her, and this is 50 years later, and she's still afraid about what happened. But wow. But after the incident, she was told by, you know, the social worker, don't worry about it. It's not uncommon for a boy this age to do this sort of a thing, which it's understood very differently now. But at the yes. time, that was the kind of answer she got was, just don't worry about it.
Huh. Interesting.
And here, 50 years later, when you reach out to her and find her and contact her and say, I'm working on this story, there was a lot more that had kind of come to become common knowledge about this guy. Besides the fact that at 13 he was, you know, getting in people's houses for underwear.
Oh yeah, now so you know by the time I reached her, now he's a suspect in multiple homicides, a laundry list of other violent crimes, arsons, and what have you, most of which he's not been charged with, let alone convicted.
Yeah,
so I could see how that would stay with her.
Yeah, really.
All these years.
Yeah, she followed the story for some years, but of course, you know, not as closely as everybody else. You know, she moved away.
Because he kept going in and out of the news all of his life, it seemed like.
That was
periods of time when he wasn't in the news, but he would come back in.
People would lose track.
He had a charmed life, I will say that. He did lead a charmed life.
What did she tell you about him or about that incident? Did she have any details?
She had an incredible amount of details. I mean, she talks about, she was a young mother, recently married, moves into this house on Tracy Avenue. And Robert Gross at that time was a teenager living in the basement of his parents' house across the backyards from her house. Mm-hmm. They have adjoining backyards. And, you know, she and her husband started noticing strange things around the house. At night, they would hear noises outside the window. They thought it was an animal. The husband bought a pellet gun. And then she would come home from going shopping and see cupboards open or a window open that she was sure was closed or money missing off of the dining room buffet. And she maybe thought her husband grabbed it on the way out. When the husband was out of town, she would be at home alone with their young daughter. And sometimes she would stay with her parents at their house in order not to be at home alone. But she told us this whole story of being at her parents' house one of these evenings and gets a call. There's lights going on and off at her home where there's not supposed to be anybody. And her dad grabs his gun and they rush over there, you know, with the police just behind him. And dad leads the police into the house, going in front and back doors, lights going on, commotion behind him. And they drag this guy out. In her memory, he was 6 foot tall at age 15. Of course, you remember people being bigger.
Yeah.
And, you know, in hindsight, but she fainted. You know, just on seeing this.
She was there as well?
She went with her dad, and she's sitting in the car watching all this go on and fainted in the car. She was, you know, terrified.
Wow. Is that normal police procedure, Gary, to have the dad, you're the police, you're going to send him through the front door first with a gun? Why don't you go on and see what's going on in there? You own the place.
I don't know how.
It was a different time.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sequence of events. He calls and he jumps in the car and runs over there.
And they show up behind him.
And I don't know if the police got there before or after. More than likely, if he ran in and did something, then the cops got there right after he got there, more than likely. Because if they'd have got there first, why, they would have said, you just wait here, we'll go in and take care of this.
Right. Yeah.
And put that gun up, by the way. Go put right. that gun back
yeah,
in your car, by
nowadays,
the way.
You wouldn't even be holding the gun, no matter who you were, when the cops show up.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's a different era. You're talking, you know, this is, you know, what we're, so we, he was born in 52, and we're talking, he's about 15 years old in 1965, and, you know, at is that right?
Born in 51.
51.
September of 51. So when a lot of these things happen, you know, he hasn't had his birthday yet. But yeah, you have 1960, first recorded incident at 8 years old. And then these burglaries happening in 65, 67.
And all the time, he's, on the other hand, he's like a high school student. Yeah, he's got friends in high school on the football team. He's got friends in high school. If I remember your article right,
yeah, I've heard from some of his high school buddies from the football team, and they didn't know, you know, at the time they didn't know necessarily about the burglaries, although they'd heard that he'd been suspected of window peeping. But they didn't know about some of this, but they had their own stories to tell about, you know, pulling a knife on during an argument or showing up in somebody's house at night and watching them sleep. You know, these are things, stories we heard from people from the football team. But
yeah, interesting. So now fast forward on to one of the first murders that he was a suspect in. When that was the, remind me.
First homicides, or the double homicide in 1979, Wanda Conkling and William Cadwallader.
So now she worked at a massage parlor.
Wanda, right? Conkling worked at the VIP massage parlor on Truman Road, which was in that area they call the Dog Patch. It's mm-hmm. in that unincorporated area between Kansas City and Independence. It was, I mean, the massage parlor was basically a trailer, but she worked there with a lot of women who worked there.
Sure, I mean, it was a big double wide trailer. The guy that ran it was kind of, you know, being in Dog Patch and. Or a unincorporated area, the law enforcement was a bit lax over there. It wasn't the city. It wasn't Independence. It was the county, and the county didn't really have a big, at that time especially, they didn't have a big law enforcement capability. They mainly ran the jail back then. And so there was some hinky things going on at the old VIP, and that guy that owned it was a little bit hinky himself, but he was politically connected too, which was interesting. So he could keep some, especially a county law enforcement, out of there. But he loved those massage parlors, didn't he?
He owned more than one, as I understand.
Yeah. What was his name?
The owner was Ted Irving. Ted Irving II, I believe, the owner of this particular one.
That's interesting, though, that they would put the massage parlor in a trailer, and then, because, you know, obviously city ordinances, city to city, you're going to be maybe specific.
It wasn't in a city.
Because it was in, I like that, the Dog Patch. It was in the county laws and ordinance different. The guy just has a trailer.
Yeah.
Do they have a sign that says, if this double wide's rocking, don't come knocking?
I don't think so.
I don't know if they had any kind of sign.
I don't think they're doing massages in there.
They had the VIP, and you could park around back. I remember that. You could hide your car from the streets, like those old motels that have a little garage next mm-hmm. to the motel room. You're meeting your girlfriend, you can hide one of your cars in the garage next to the motel. Nope. But anyhow, so... That Wanda Conkling, that was an interesting investigation. I have some vague memory of it because there was some kind of mafia implication of that. They thought maybe they had gotten crossways somehow, or Ted Irving had. It was some kind of a message from the mob.
The investigation did go in an organized crime direction because Wanda Conkling and her husband, William Cadwallader, turned up dead. They were killed in their house with a shotgun. And the police investigating found out that, yes, Wanda worked at the VIP massage parlor, and while there had become associated with Robert Gross, the gentleman that we've been talking about. While she was split up from her husband, she had been dating him a little bit and then reunited with her husband before being killed. At the same time, they're turning up information that the husband, William Cadwallader, was reputed around town to be... part of a crew of organized shoplifters that were tenuously connected to organized crime, that they would be shoplifting, stealing things, and then selling them through a local fence.
Right. Those are the guys that were, I think they were boosting record albums and selling to Tigers Records down on Independence Avenue. Back in those days, you could, these guys, they were going all over the Midwest because record stores, they had no security, and there was every shopping center had a record store with a big front door and one little girl working in there, one, you know, geek guy that wanted to just love records or something working in there, and they'd go in and load up on those record albums and do these shoplifting or boosting tours throughout the Midwest and bring them back and sell them to Tiger for about 25 cents on the dollar. Tiger sell these brand new albums, the latest albums out, for about 75 cents on the dollar. You could always buy the latest album from Tiger's Records for about three quarters the price of the record store. The
difference was Tiger actually had some security around.
Yeah, well,
they might not actually been there, but when they did ticket sales, because we're talking, this is old days where you would actually buy concert tickets at places like at the Tiger's record store from Tiger. And so Izzy and Uncle Frank were some of those guys that would kind of keep an eye on things.
Yeah, that's probably how Tiger got killed. He absconded with a bunch of that Tiger money, or that ticket money, and And the guy that was contracting to do that was mad, and I think he pulled the ticket sales out of those stores, which pretty much was the death of the stores. Anyhow, Tiger was killed, and his pockets were slit open, which indicates he'd been stealing money from somebody.
Right.
That's just my theory.
When his body was found in the...
I think it's in the East Bottoms in his car, in the trunk of his car, the back seat. I can't remember now. Anyhow, Tiger's dead. But
here's William.
So we go down this organized crime path because Cadwaller has been boosting and selling to Tiger. Maybe they think he's going to be an informant or something like that.
The question was of the you have this married couple that had been killed, and which one of them was the actual target, and which one was killed, you know, as a bystander? Was Wanda the target of the killing? Or was Willie? And so the detectives, it was a 12-member squad specially put together to solve this, and they pursued both angles. They went deep on the organized crime angle, and they interviewed all these people that Willie Cadwaller knew, and they were asking. They went as far as Oregon to chase down a story about somebody was mad at Willie, and he was afraid they were going to kill him. It didn't pan out to be anything, at least based on the reading of the investigation. But at the same time, they were investigating Robert Gross because the thought was he'd been dating Wanda. She threw him over to go back to her husband. He was mad. And so they investigated him and turned up a lot of circumstantial evidence that he could have been involved. At least that's what the detectives who investigated it have said.
But they never found the weapon?
No, yeah, there was no weapon that you could point to that was the murder weapon. No eyewitness to the killing. No physical evidence or clues that you could point to say who did this.
But it was at their home.
That's correct, yeah.
And then so there was no appearance of forced entry.
No.
So maybe somebody came up to the door and they knew them enough that they would unlock and open the door to let them in.
Logically, it makes sense. They were right in their living room in the front of their house. In fact, they were about to go on a second honeymoon, so they even had a bag packed by the door that was also hit by a shotgun blast.
Wow.
So it looked very much like somebody had just come up and knocked on the door, and the door opens, and bam, bam. Hmm.
So they don't make a case on him. Then when did he rear his ugly head again after that? Was that Lisa Morris? Or not Lisa Morris, was that?
Cheryl Morris.
Cheryl Morris.
2 years later, 1981, Cheryl Morris, 31-year-old, part-time college student and a server at the old Patricio's restaurant, 99th and Holmes. She gets off a shift at the restaurant, walks out, disappears. And she remained missing for 6 years.
And that's when we got into it big time with the surveillance. That's when people said, ooh, wait a minute, this is the third person we know of that he's a suspect in, and two of them have been women.
And Gross was connected to that case because while police started investigating her disappearance, her mother asked if police had heard the name Robert Gross come up, and it hadn't to that point. But once they started looking into it, they became very interested because Gross had gone out with Cheryl a couple of times. She was afraid of him. They'd had run-ins at the restaurant, and coincidentally or not, the place where Wanda and Willie were killed was just about a half mile or a mile from the restaurant. So this is all in the same. This is all occurring in the same geographic area as
and,
well.
And he lives within. At that time, he lived out there on Blue Ridge. He lived within a mile or so of that restaurant. Also,
that was going to be my question: was where did he live in vicinity to all this?
He lived pretty close,
114th Street,
right?
But he had a vehicle or something. Yes.
Yeah, he was driving a blue Plymouth Duster. 74.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, and he had come back to the restaurant, I think, several times and stalked her and harassed her, trying to get her to go back out with him. Is that kind of his usual MO?
Her family told me, and now her parents have passed on, but I spoke with two of her cousins and an aunt, and they said the last thing they remember her talking about was being afraid of this guy who they'd gone out a couple times. She told him she didn't want to see him anymore, but he would not take no for an answer. And he became very angry, and then suddenly her car is being vandalized in the parking lot. The tires slashed and taillights disconnected.
Yeah.
And there was actually like police reports of this vandalism, and you could follow back up to or just their descriptions.
The reports of the vandalism came up in the investigation of her disappearance. I don't know that she'd reported those acts of vandalism to the police, but it all sounded very similar to things that had been reported by a former girlfriend of his in the 1970s. Who said that he had vandalized her car when he became angry with her. So it all became part of a pattern that you saw repeated again and again over the course of five decades.
Right. That's when we threw a big squad on him, Aaron. We put about, I don't know, 15 guys, I think, at one time on him. That's the one where I used a motorcycle to help follow him. And we didn't even have, like, any handheld mics or anything. I just sat on the...
curb?
No, I sat on the walkie-talkie. And I was the guy that if he got a little bit ahead, you can take a motorcycle and you can catch up with anybody in no time. So he got a little bit ahead of everybody, and I would lay into it and catch up with him. And then I'd have to pull over and stop and pull a walkie-talkie out and radio back, okay, here's where he is or here's where he's going now. And they'd eventually catch back up. But, yeah, it was a full-time, 18-hour-a-day surveillance. Caught him shoplifting, but, I mean, we didn't turn him in, but we that's how he was making his money. He wasn't working anywhere at the time. He was boosting stuff at stores.
So maybe that's kind of interesting that if he was boosting, then he maybe knew William, who he killed previously,
yeah,
because they ran some of the same crew lines.
No.
You don't think so?
That would have come up. You know, that would have come up because he was...
You think he was just working independently?
Well, he was just doing this. He was not part of that, any kind of a crew.
A different kind of shoplifting.
Yeah, they were stealing for almost on order for Tiger. This guy was going into like Kmart and getting a what they caught him doing one time was get a barbecue grill.
You had thrown out the name of a store that I hadn't thought of since I was a kid, but you mentioned Venture.
Yeah, Venture.
Which really took me back.
Venture was one of them. I said Kmart. I think it was a Venture store. And he would fill that barbecue grill full of small high-dollar items and then seal the box back up and go buy the barbecue grill. And then he could return. He'd have the receipt, and he could return the barbecue grill and get his money back and take those other items and sell them somewhere. We never did figure out where he was selling them that I remember. So it was a heck of an investigation. And in the end, we served a search warrant on him. He got caught in a arson. Remind me of the sequence of events. All of a sudden, I've lost it.
This is now... 3 years after Cheryl Morris has disappeared.
And yeah.
You've been tailing him.
I've been tailing him off and on for three years.
No case on him. 3 years after she disappears, up north of the river in Clay County, house explodes early in the morning. I mean, throws wood, lumber all over the place, 100 feet in every direction, on the roofs of nearby houses. A witness sees a guy running from the scene on fire and jumps in a little blue car, just similar to what Robert Gross was known to drive. Gross himself turns up at KU Med Center about an hour later, badly burned, ends up in the emergency room. Cops find his car parked about a block away, search the car, two sawed-off shotguns, two cans of gasoline, a map that leads to the house that just blew up, all kinds of things in there. And then ultimately, yes, search warrant on his house on 114th Street.
And that's the one where the squad that served the search warrant, they took a saw and cut into the side of the house because they had heard from a neighbor or something that he may have booby-trapped his house. So they cut a hole in the side of the house to go in and send the bomb people in to search and make sure there wasn't any booby traps in there.
It was quite a scene from what I understand, because the Star wrote about it at the time, because the police had four blocks, I think, blocked off.
Yeah, they evacuated some houses.
Yeah, the 30 or so police running around, and they were there for more than a day, 35, 36 hours searching this house.
They went through that house with a fine-tooth comb.
Is there a physical address you could give for that house that you saw it into to get it where he lived? Is that in the story? I'm just curious because, you know, people that are crime fans like that kind of stuff where they could drive by the house.
I wouldn't give the address just because somebody else lives there.
Somebody else lives there now.
I would say it was
always the case.
I would say it was on 114th Street.
114th and about Blue Ridge.
Now Blue Ridge.
Anyhow, now we don't want to give that address out. So there's one little interesting side story, and then we're going to have to get out of here. Ian, can you come back next week and finish this off?
Oh, sure, no problem.
Modern, here's one little story that Ian didn't put in there because we don't know all the details of this, folks, but there was a private detective that broke into Gross's house during that time and tried to find some evidence. I understood he didn't find any evidence. Nobody ever mentioned that story, and we'll just leave it at that. But
it's a tantalizing
little thing, isn't it?
But they find two sawed-off shotguns in his car.
Yeah, but you can't tie them to anything.
Well, that was enough to charge him in the arson, but the arson case was eventually dropped.
Did they have? Was there a reason for the arson? Was it another one of these jilted lover stories?
Nobody that I know of has ever uncovered the exact reason for the arson. However, we do understand that at the time, Gross was partners in a bar with a guy who owned that house at one time and sold it to a woman. So Gross did have some connection to the house, and I think one of the police investigating it suggested that there was some kind of a personal grudge behind it. But I've never heard an exact reason what for.
Which would make sense. All right, Ian, this is a really interesting story, and I look forward next week to finishing this off. So okay. I will do my public service announcement. Aaron, if you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to rent. But you're going to want to buy it because you're going to watch it over and over. The details are amazing. And then you think you know something, and you don't know anything at all until you get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Gary has distilled down the wiretap audio to the most salient points. And then when you read the words from the mouth of the men that did it, you're going to want to hear it from the mouth of the men that did it. And you can, because Gary has a Kindle version of that book with hyperlinks to video that has the actual audio from the mouth of the men that did it. And then there's even more to know, because in Kansas City, there's a great mob history, and you're going to want to check that out with Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $2.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Ian.
Goodnight.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.